So welcome everyone. So before we get into, can everybody hear me with the ACL? Before we get into our formal teaching, we always begin with if anybody has any questions. If you're new, any questions about the mindfulness meditation practices that we did tonight, or any questions about meditation in general, or any questions about the teachings and practices of, let's say, Buddhism, and how to bring it into one's life, to make one's life better, happier, richer, more meaningful, etc. So if anybody have any questions, please don't be shy. Please ask whatever you'd like. Yes. The day we had a day of mindfulness on Sunday at the Lotus Pond, yeah.
What you said about the branch falling down from the tree, we don't blame the branches, conditions and sources. And the same applies to another person. I have a hard time with that. You know, I've been fighting that all week.
Good.
You know?
Well, first of all, Gary, I am happy that you are struggling with it.
Thank you so much.
Because, you know, because that means it affected you.
Yes.
And yet it's challenging something, some kind of belief system, something. And that's good. I mean, what Gary is doing, we should all do. I mean, we're... The Buddha, again, he did not teach a dogma. He didn't teach a catechism. Even when he saw that his disciples, were being very good disciples and taking everything on, you know, because he's the Buddha and he's their teacher, and he said it. He said to them, do not, you know, take what I say just because I am your teacher, just because you respect me, just because you love me, etc., etc. You know, that's fine. But, you know, chew on it. You know, and make sure that whatever teaching practices I give you, you know, it makes intellectual sense of it. You can understand it. And then when you reflect on it and see how to apply it, you understand it and you see the benefits it brings in your life. You know, and if you do that, then, you know, it's fine. Right? So let me just say, for people who weren't there, a lot of the teachings on Sunday related, we taught from Shantideva, an 8th century great Indian Buddhist master. 8th century, this is 21st century, so it sounds like a long time ago. And yet his teachings were very relevant. And we're dealing with his teachings on patience, which very interestingly for those of us in America, because he posits patience as the antidote for anger, which is not usually the way we see it at all. And Shantideva was making many points, but one of the points that Gary's referring to was this whole thing we have about blaming, right? We blame people for what they said, for what they did, for what they didn't say, for what they should have said, could have said, would have said, right? But we tend to blame people for that, right? And Shantideva was making a point. He's saying, we don't blame inanimate things, right? For example, Gary, is an example we gave, which was, if you're out in the forest and all of a sudden a branch falls from a tree and hits you on the head, you don't get enraged at the tree, right? You don't curse the tree and go home and tell everybody about that so-and-so tree, and can you believe what it did? And there I was out there enjoying myself, and it just, right? Because why? Because one, we don't usually do that to inanimate things. And two, we know that the falling of the branch just had to do with kind of cause, what in Buddhism we call cause and conditions. You know, the branch, the aging, the wind, we don't know what. But something all came together at that moment. What? And that it fell, and at the same time, because of my causes and conditions, I was walking underneath, and it was just a coming together, right? And he also used the example of, if we have an upset stomach, right? We don't hate our stomach, right? That damn stomach. It's always caught. You know what I mean? We understand that the stomach is kind of inanimate and it's just responding to cause and condition, something, something like that. All right. So then he goes, Shanti Devi, this is where Gary's going, I don't get that leap. Then he goes, but when it comes to animate, you know, like human beings, we don't do that, right? If somebody says or does or something like that, we get angry at them because we think they shouldn't have done it or they knew better or et cetera, et cetera. And so Shanti Deva's point is that is not true. That the same way that that tree, the tree's branch, it's falling, was only the cause of causes, you know, causing conditions. The tree didn't have a choice. The tree didn't think about dropping a branch on you. It just happened to fall at that time. In the same way, he said, all human beings includes who? Us. Everybody we know, everybody we're in relationship with, of all types. His point was, all of us are being impelled by the causes and conditions that have formed us. And in this moment, right, we are acting or reacting not consciously, not because we choose to, but because of, you know, our conditioning, our habit force, our right, is propelling us to act or not act in this moment the way we do. The idea that somehow we are consciously choosing, right, is not the case. And most of us know that. You know, when we are angry, right, we may say and do things, the harm of which we only realize when? After we do it, right? After we say it. And the impulsion to say and act in a certain way is being, you know, is just coming out of us. So basically, Shanti Deva's point was, he used the example of, you know, again, if somebody is beating you with a stick, right? Are you angry at the stick? No. You'd be angry at the person who's wielding the stick, right? The stick is just an instrument of the person wielding it. And he's saying the same way, a human being who says or does or acts in a way that causes you suffering, right? Let's say. They are just an instrument of their own karmic forces. And I think that's worth looking deeply at. So he's saying, it's okay, you know, if you want to be angry, be angry at anger. Be angry at violence. Be angry at intolerance, right? But understand that the person who is being gripped by these forces is trapped, right? Is trapped. Now, that doesn't mean, one, that person can't change, right? That doesn't mean that we, if I say something unkind to Doug in anger, right, that I cannot reflect on that, see the damage I've done, and make an effort, right, to apologize to him and to do my own work on myself so I don't still react in my conditioning ways. But the reason I reacted the way I did at the time, it just happened because I was still totally in the throes of my conditioning, my reactivity. And I'm glad Gary said that's not hard because we are very used to what? To blaming. Right? Because we live in a world where we think what? They should know better. Right? Oh, they knew what they were doing. They just wanted to what? Hurt me. But think about when you're angry with somebody and you have angry thoughts, speak angry words, or even act out in ways that create harm. You know, why are you doing it? What's propelling you? And I think if you look deeply, you realize in that moment, You don't even know what's propelling you. Right? We're just acting. And in that moment, we cannot be any different than we are. Now, the next moment, maybe we can be. Right? If something else comes into mind. But in that moment, and so that's what he means. Right? And it's interesting, because if you think about, you know, things like nonviolent movements, you know, Martin Luther King, Gandhi, things like that, this is what they said, right? Hate the sin, not the sinner, right? You know, don't hate the British. Don't hate the sheriffs, you know. Hate prejudice. Hate intolerance. Hate bigotry. Because these people, their minds, that's what they're trapped by, right? That's what's causing them to act the way they are, right? Why am I, you know, why am I, self-righteous me, not acting that way? Because my mind's been conditioned in another way, right? And it's not necessarily that it's because I'm better than. It's just that I have different past, different causes and conditions have entered my life. It could very, you know, that wonderful poem by Thich Nhat Hanh, Call Me By My True Name. People know that poem. It's a wonderful poem. Where he just acknowledges. He wrote the poem during the time of the boat people. I don't know if everybody remembers the time of the boat people when tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese were fleeing the country. And they were just taken to boats. And many of them, and they just headed out into the China Sea and everything, trying to make land in another country. And they were set upon by pirates. Many of them pirates from Thailand. I mean, who were pirates. It was sort of like that's, you know, that's what they did for a living. And so many of them, you know, these poor innocent people out there in the middle of the ocean, you know, fleeing, were often attacked by pirates. They were robbed, they were raped, some of them were killed, so, you know, a horrible condition. And in Thich Nhat Hanh's poem, he said, I am the nine-year-old, or I forget who's being raped by the pirate, I am the pirate. Because I know that if I was born in such and such a village on the coast, where the only way my family earned their living was by pirating, and I had grown up in that environment, Thich Nhat Hanh said, I'd be a pirate today, bro. You know, we think we're better than others, especially others who, right, act in ways that we think are reprehensible, right? And from a certain point, to have a sense of moral judgment and is certainly good, right? But we also understand what separates us from this other person is not necessarily of our own choosing, right? Very few people really rise above their conditioning, right? Most people live out their conditioning. Obviously, people who embark on a spiritual practice, a path where they're trying to transform, to change, to shift, to use the practices of meditation, to look deeply into the things within their minds that control them, the habit forces that they just react from that often do not produce happiness and well-being for themselves and others, but produce suffering. I mean, the amount of people who really look deeply into their conditioning, right, and very consciously going back, going along a program of change, right, is few. Right, that's not what most people in this world are up to. Does that answer your question?
Well, which is wonderful, but it's certainly. Softened and broadened, and it gives me other dimensions and happy to do the chewing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I appreciate that. You know, appreciate the response. And it's been clarified to some extent for me. And so it's great.
And again, I would just say, Gary, as you continue to chew on it, look deeply into your own actions of body, speech, and mind, and the actions of others, and see, is there some, in Buddhism, of course, it goes even further. There's no self. So when you blame the self, you're also falsely postulating something. But we don't even need to go there. Right? I realize we are animate, and we have a mind. We are different than trees. But yet, are we not, many of us, controlled by circumstances as much as inanimate objects? It's worth looking at.
You used to remember a piece that I put in there, and part that I think I was stumbling on a little bit, is sort of the difference between blame and accountability.
That's very different. It's funny, actually. It was interesting because Chandi Devi had a number of teachings on how to deal with difficult people, angry people, people do harm, and of course another teaching he gave was he said that people who give you a hard time. People who cause you suffering, people who disappoint you, people who get you angry, right? These are your teachers, right? Because without them, he said, we will not develop. How do you become patient unless you have people who drive you crazy, right? How else do you do it? And so it was interesting. What he said was, If you praise and worship Buddhas and teachers, people who inspire you and instruct you, right, in how to live and how to love and how to understand, he said you should at least 50% worship and praise your enemies. He said because they equally are contributing to your transformations. It's it is another one of those things that you go, what? Right? How can that be? But from the point of view of a transformation, it is. Now, I'm only bringing that up because afterwards, a woman came up to me, and I said, it's too bad you didn't bring this up, because, of course, it's true. She said, does this mean if you're a woman in an abusive relationship, you should look upon your abuser as, your best friend who's helping you? And I said, of course, absolutely not. This is not an excuse for something like that. So there is some common sense here, right? So there is accountability. But even if you have a system, let's say a quote-unquote a criminal justice system, remember it's called that? It's called the criminal justice system, right? Not just the criminal punishment system. So even just for the sake of maintaining the context of our civilized interaction and saying that certain behaviors are injurious to other human beings and to the social good, it doesn't mean we have to hate people, does it? It doesn't mean we only have to have negative attitudes toward them and want to do them harm, right? We can hold people accountable for their actions, but understand that at this point, for the better well-being of society, they may have to be circumscribed, jailed, I don't know, punished in certain ways. But we understand that there are causes and conditions that have created them, right? If anybody has worked in the criminal justice system or worked with people or been around people or known people go to jail, they're not all necessarily bad people. Right? Many of them are drug addicts, right? Alcoholics, and many of them have been abused. Many of them are poor. There are all kinds of circumstances that have created this human being to act the way they do, right? And again, it doesn't mean that you then go, let them do whatever they want because, they can't help themselves, right? You have to hold them accountable, but you don't have to hate them, and you can want to rehabilitate. Do anybody here see the Dahmer Brothers movie? The Dahmer brothers, we showed it. Incredible. It's called Dahmer Brothers. You can get it from Netflix, or you're on Netflix. I have it, and we did a showing at the Lotus Pond a couple of months ago. Incredible. It's Dahmer Brothers. It takes place in a maximum security prison in Alabama. Okay, this is a place that nobody wants to end up. Okay, it is hell. It's the end of the road. It's maximum security. Most of the guys in there are murderers, repeat felons, you know, and many of them are in there for life, right? Tough guys, right? Without going, it's a documentary, profound. Through a bunch of circumstances having to do with actually the prison psychologist, so many efforts at rehabilitation failing. Somehow he heard about Buddhist meditation, Vipassana meditation, and through a bunch of good fortune, he invited two meditation teachers in the Vipassana Buddhist meditative tradition to come to the prison and put on a 10-day, very strict, totally silent meditation retreat, for about which 20 or 25 guys signed up. So this is a documentary about that whole process, about the retreat, and also a lot to do with these gentlemen, right? Their past, what got them in, their families, their life in prison, and their experience in the retreat, and then they share their experience. It is incredible. Incredible. I mean, those of you who have seen it, the transformations are incredible. And if I remember, I think most of them were murderers. Right? We're in for murder. And yet, when you see this, you realize some of them are just, you know, wonderful human beings who never touched a healthy place in themselves. Right? Because of the conditions they grew up in. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh says, all of us, which means all of us, In our storehouse consciousness, our alaya vijnana, we have all kinds of seeds of good things and seeds of not so good things. Right? We have seeds of love and compassion and caring and patience and understanding and mindfulness and et cetera, right? And we have seeds of anger and violence and hatred and intolerance and fear, right? So we all have those seeds, right? And a lot of how we grow is what seeds get watered. What seeds get watered by our parents, what seeds get watered by our families, what seeds get, you know, watered in our neighborhood, our schools, our communities, our country, our world, right? Depending on, you know, has a lot to do with how we develop, isn't it? Well, what's really clear with these guys as they tell their story is the seeds that got watered in their life were not seeds of love, seeds of understanding, seeds of compassion. Hard seeds were watered. And so they became hard. But it's just wonderful to see when they are finally at the end of their rope and are just sitting day and night in silence, how so many of them just break through that shell, that encasing, and all of a sudden their humanity just springs forth. It's really a marvelous story of the power of meditation, but even more so, I think it's a marvelous story about the capacity of human beings, and that all human beings, no matter how screwed up, no matter how messed up, no matter how distorted their life is, still maintain the capacity for a pure kind of humanity. If they're able to find a way to touch that. Dahmer Brothers, I recommend you see it. Are there other questions? Yes.
I'm new to this mm-hmm. group.
Good.
And I'm not familiar with the chant that was done at the beginning. I was wondering what that means.
Oh, it's just a chant that says, homage to Shakyamuni Buddha. Shakyamuni Buddha is not a god, right? Shakyamuni Buddha is the founder of Buddhism. He is a man who lived 2,500 years ago, who embarked on his own spiritual quest for meaning and purpose and understanding. And through his own deep looking into the nature of reality in his mind, awoke to the full capacity of what it means to be a human being. He became awake. He awoke. Right? And he was called the Buddha. The Buddha just means the enlightened one. And he taught for nearly 50 years, had many disciples, and from that has come this whole river of Buddhism for 2,500 years. So we're just kind of honoring that, the founder. So that's what that is. Thank you. Any other questions? A man who speaks the truth.
So I just, I'm not sure, I feel like there's a place where I'm trying to figure out a small way how to be present in the moment in my life. And I see guidance.
Okay, so Steve is saying, one of the great, his great pleasures in life is listening to music in his car. But he notices that the way he gets into it and where it kind of leads him is really kind of an escape from whatever. But he likes it. And oftentimes when he turns off the radio and just drives, it's not as pleasant an experience. Right?
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting, Steve, that you should be sitting next to a 2-month-old baby. That's what she's got in there. Because it has something to do with that. You know, how we go from that to that. You know, it's interesting, right? Because that baby, we could say, is fairly pure, right? It doesn't need a lot of music or stimulation, right? It's just very alive, isn't it? Right? I mean, I spent a little time with that baby a little earlier today. It loves just kind of looking around. And seems very interested and curious in what it's seeing. Right? And that baby also does not have a strong sense of himself. He probably has very little, if no, sense of self. He's just here, totally open. Right? That's right. So how do we get from there to there? Well, things happen, don't they? Right? Things happen. And the mind gets filled up and stimulated and filled up and twisted this way and that way. And, you know, we grow a great big sense of self and me and my, and I like this and I don't like that and I need this, right? And it just, right? I mean, how do we get from, I mean, he needs what? He needs basically to eat. And when he gets dirty, he needs somebody to wipe him. Right? And then, you know. And somebody to hold. I mean, it's very simple needs, and it doesn't take much to make him happy. Right? A little milk, a little contact, right? Even smiles. Right? And somehow, in our great development, we have lost that capacity, haven't we? We need now so much, right? To stimulate. We need so much to be happy. Now, is that inherently bad? You know, like evil or immoral? No. But it is like you say, there is a difference between a happiness and a well-being that comes from the inside and a happiness that always has to be manufactured. And we know we live in a society that is perhaps the most sophisticated society, right, ever created to keep us preoccupied with stimulating, interesting stuff, right? Nonstop. Right? We can be distracted, we can escape from whatever, you know, 24 hours a day, can't we? And, you know, every year there's something new. But if all this kind of advancement or development or stimulation is really good, right, then we should we be what? Happier. Right? I mean, should be happier. Because somehow, I mean, most human beings would say that, yes, in life, I would like to be happy. Seems to be a state of mind that most human beings would like to dwell in. I'd like to be happy. I'd like to lead a happy, purposeful, meaningful life. So this world that we live in now gives us constant information that is telling us we're very active and things are changing, right? But the truth is, it's sort of like, I think, the rat, you know, on the wheel. A lot of activity, right? Have you ever seen the rat on the wheel? Very busy, that rat. Very busy, very active. But it never gets the cheese. It never, you know. So there's something inherently unsatisfactory about that. And it is for that reason that we may be, again, there's nothing inherently wrong with music, is there? And there's nothing wrong with really enjoying life or the things that life has. But what you're pointing to is, what you're noticing, right, is that you're not free. Because when you turn off the radio, it sucks, right? So you're caught. And you're beginning to say, well, maybe it's really not just about enjoying music, it's really about escaping. Because when I am just alone, just, you know, alive, it's kind of boring, right? Yeah, it kind of just sucks. So how do we get from that to that? Right? Layers of conditioning that just are covering us, that we're unable just to touch life as it is deeply. We're not connected. So unfortunately, Steve, this is the unfortunate thing, right? And again, I always compare it to, you know, it's no different than an addiction, right? When you're an addict, for those of you who've ever been an addict or know addicts, addicts are very busy maintaining their addiction, right? I mean, it's a full-time job, right? And they're always looking to what? To get high, stay high, because why? They think it's happiness, right? But the truth is, they are addicted, they're trapped. And there's incredible suffering in their life, right? So when they get out of the game of addiction, right? When they realize, I got to stop my addiction because it's really not getting me what we want, it's actually harming me, right? So when an addict stops their addiction, they go through something called what? Withdrawal. And from my understanding of people who've gone through withdrawal, withdrawal sucks, right? And even though the addict often knows they're better off now that they're not using, right? But oftentimes, they don't like life. It's kind of boring, kind of dull. It's not like it used to be, right? You know what I mean? So So what you say is, you know, as you begin to pull yourself back, right, from this world of stimulation and escapism, right, and kind of just kind of come, try to come into reality just as it is, it's like not that wonderful right away. It kind of seems flat or boring or nothing's going on. You know what I mean? It's sort of like we're what? Teenagers. If you remember being a teenager, if you're old, if you have children who are teenagers. Teenagers, right? When there's no stimulation, life is what? Boring. It's like two things, stimulation, boring. And most teenagers choose what? Stimulation, action. Because it's not, it's boring. I mean, it's like there's no thing worse than being bored. So we often have to go through that. Because what we, through the practice of, well, the practices of a meditative path and mindfulness, we actually learn that living life just as it is, touching life just as it is actually quite wonderful. Because to connect with reality, it's like when we do walking meditation, we say what? You know, feel the earth under your feet. You're touching the earth, right? Experience ourselves walking. We don't usually do that, do we? We're walking somewhere, but we're thinking about where we were or where we're getting to or something else, right? We're never present. So how do we ever experience reality? We're always experiencing our thoughts, right? Well, no wonder we don't feel connected. No wonder we don't feel whole. If you're always living in your thoughts, thoughts have no substance, right? So in the moment, you know, we're stimulated. We've escaped from what? What did we escape from? The reality that when the music stops, I feel alone. Right? I feel lonely. I feel sad. We don't want to feel. Right? You know, and then the question is, you know, are you willing to go through, to come into reality, to touch the reality of where you are, even if it's painful, so you can use the tools of transformation and healing to come out the other side, to become whole? Unfortunately, you don't go from brokenness to wholeness, from disconnection to connection, like that. You know, unfortunately, there's this. Right? And that, you know, can suck at times, can be boring at times, can be difficult at times, right? You know, that's why, I'm not in the recovery movement, but I spent my life in the mental health field and worked with a lot, you know, with recovered people, and I know the movement well. That's why people in recovery go to meetings, right, and have sponsors, right? Because it's not their experience yet that this is really a better way and it's possible to live drug and alcohol free and have a happy, good life. Better than when I was, you know, the life of the party. Right? So that's why we often need teachers, we often need mentors and who tell us, right, there is another way, that in their lives show us, right, that it is possible to live another way, right, and support us until we get to the place where it's now our own experience. So in that transition time, we probably do need more support and help and nurturance, you know what I'm saying, than we will need. Just in the same way that little infant there, at this point, you know, needs total care. I mean, total, absolute care. Hopefully, you know, 10 years from now, Anna won't be carrying him around, you know, still like that, you know, and feeding him and bathing him, wiping him, you know, right? Because he will hopefully learn to take care of himself, right? But this, at this point, he needs lots of help and support. And so a lot of times in the early stages of our transformation, we may need more care, more support, more help, right? Not because there's anything intrinsically wrong with us, just because, you know, we don't know the terrain yet. But in time we will. So maybe turn off the radio every other time. And just, you know, this is a practice of understanding, not of, you know, renunciation. So what you want to do is turn off the radio and then watch your mind. See what happens. You know, just watch yourself. Watch the mind, watch it play its games, watch it need, want, you know, get angry, who knows what it does, right? You know, learn about it. And then another time, just as you're driving, just kind of be relaxed and very kind of open to the experience of driving. You know, just very focused and present. You come to red lights, you know, and you got a minute, look up and see the sky. How beautiful. Right. Running around here, driving from here to there, got all these things to do, you know. Oh, there's a big, beautiful sky. Right. I didn't even see it. I've been so busy with important things. Right. We're all so busy with our important things.
You mentioned the word karma, and it sounded as if it was a synonym for causes and conditions, and I wanted that clarified.
Yeah, it is kind of cause and effect, right? Cause and effect is a synonym for the Sanskrit word karma. It just means that, you know, that this world operates on cause and effect. It's not a random universe, that if something has happened here, if one looks deep enough, one can see the causes. Main causes, subsidiary causes, endless causes. And the same way that every action in the present, which has antecedent causes, is also a cause for future effects. Right? And that is, you know, that's kind of the mechanism where we understand, you know, that transformation is possible. Right? Because I can understand how I got here. Right, I can see the whole pattern of, you know, all the pattern of causes that got me to being here, right? But I can also see that if I begin to create new causes, think differently, act differently, et cetera, I can see that I can move my life in different directions because things aren't fixed, things aren't permanent, right? So karma, even though it's used in a pop sense, it's really quite a profound understanding of how this, you know, phenomenal universe operates. Do something.
Yeah. Taking the example of driving.
Driving. Yeah.
Right. For instance, driving here, the moon was just. I think we get into the rut of letting stimulus really interfere with even more beautiful stimulus. And that stimulus is in front of us everywhere.
Right.
All the time. And so, you know, when I first started my coming here a couple of years ago, I was speaking with a friend about being present while we're driving. And I really started an exercise of seeing things I notice while I'm driving that I pass by every day and don't notice. And the number of birds I see flying by while I'm driving. And the things that are all around me that normally I might be distracted from. And that became my new entertainment. While I was driving, was really this conscious effort there, mm-hmm. being wrapped up in
right.
and so many other things. So it became a very entertaining exercise, and really it came to me through discussing practice with yeah. someone else.
Yeah, I mean, we are natural beings, right? And we do belong to the natural world. But we are so caught up in our self-created, artificial, man-made world, we have lost that connection. It's because we've lost that connection that we can get to the point right now where you know, many people are suggesting that many of the life support systems of our planet are breaking down, right? You know, how can that happen? Because we have lost that sense of, you know, we are the natural world.
Speaking of being present, what happened to our beautiful grapes?
We don't know. They have. I was actually asking Nancy. They last couple weeks they painted. We're going to find out, aren't we? We are. Yeah. Yeah, the ceiling has gone about another 30 feet that we never knew was there. any other questions about practice? Yes.
Let's see.
Yeah, good.
You must summarize the lights.
Right.
I have a question, but I want to go back to the appreciation of seeds, inheriting seeds.
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 Appreciation of seeds.
Yeah, and in the book, I understand in the book, he uses the term a lot, seeds, inherent seeds. And seeds create the karma, we call it the perfume effect of karma. Now, my question has to do with the fact that, well, nothing is as clear as when it seems that when the Buddha Dharma deals with karma effect with regards to seeds, the letter does not have to be the appreciation of Takata Dharma, which is Buddha nature, is not going to be here, it's still there. My question to you is that you said this is not a practice of renunciation, it's a practice of understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I need to clarify that because I don't see a causation relationship or a difference. Because some teachers, I understand, consider renunciation simply to be our attitude towards veracity.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So
okay, so let me just quickly, as usual, you ask deep questions. I know, I've been resting for a couple of years. So without going into the various Buddhist philosophical schools, and again, please understand that you will, like take something like the five skandhas. You will read a whole slew of Buddhist teachers of renown talking about the five skandhas, what is consciousness, what is mental formation, you know, and you will see incredible differences, right? So please understand that one of the unique things about Buddhism, for those of you people who want to get into it, is there's no catechism, right? There was no coming together of one church going through all the various teachings and systems and deciding this is the true one. Okay, so what happens is you get, you know, lots of different ways of looking at things, and they're all, you know, Buddhist schools or teachings on this, and a lot of them seem somewhat contradictory or oppositional. And you go, you know, how can this be? You know, it can be very confusing. And again, it's just because that step of uniformity and homogeneity has never happened, right? Okay, because why? Because it's understood, you know, like the like the famous blind men with the elephant, you know, the people are looking at, you know, the elephant, but they're grabbing a different piece of it, looking in a different way, looking through a different filter, and it appears differently. All right, now, in Buddhist teaching, as in, you know, other religious you know, it's we don't want. Let's say we want to end our suffering, and we want to leave a life of happiness and well-being. Right? Well, one simple way to do it, right, is look at what's All right, let's come back to addiction. Right? Drugs and alcohol are bad for me. Right? I know what I'll do. I just won't drink or drug. Renunciation. Right? I will not, I'll not hang out with people who drink or drug. So I've really renounced in my life the use of alcohol and drugs, and therefore it is no... Okay.
Yeah.
I'm having trouble.
Neurologically, without the drug and whatever, you can go without it. There's something that's still in Zen, I believe, it's called the earthquake mind. You heard?
No.
Earthquake mind. Before there's an earthquake, everyone's running around, everybody's in their own being, some are bored, some are not. But the moment an earthquake hits, everyone's on the same mind.
Everybody's on that.
Everybody's on the same mind. So that kind of thing is the neurological, you know, key of not getting the
okay. So again, what I'm trying to say, and there are various levels, is traditionally to renounce something is to say no to it. I renounce something. I just say no to it because for whatever reason, it's bad for me, it's not good for you, it's not good for society. I don't want to be negatively impacted by it, so I say no to it. I renounce it. Okay? When you're coming from that place, you're basically saying that that which, right, is inherently, there's something inherently bad about it. Okay. Now, that's one way of dealing with it. Okay. There's another way of dealing with that thing, is saying there's nothing inherently bad in that. It's the way I understand or misunderstand it and misuse it. Okay. If I can understand clearly that there's nothing inherently there, the problem is here. Okay. I can work on it here and not out here. All right? So in other words, for example, traditionally in Buddhism, there are four classifications of practitioners. Laymen, laywomen, monks, and nuns. Okay? Traditionally, the path of a monk and nun is a path of renunciation. Right? You know, relationships just cause you suffering, up and down, in love, out of love, you know what I'm saying, right? I just won't deal with it. I won't have relationships. Sexuality, you know, that's a time bomb, right? Oh, no, you know, I just won't deal with it. Having possessions, things, you know, you just get attached to them, right? They end up causing you suffering. I just won't have them, right? So the path of renunciation is I'll just renounce all those things that I believe will cause me suffering so I can now be free to follow a spiritual path, okay? A lay person doesn't have that freedom, right? Because we are in the world of things. So what my teachers always said, our path, what works for lay people, is just to understand. The problem is not, you know, the imported watch. That inherently, there's nothing here, right? The attachment is here. The desire is here, right? Right? That's where the problem is. You know, if I can uproot the desire because I understand clearly what it is and how it's leading to dissatisfaction, I can have a watch or not have a watch, right? I can turn on the radio or not turn on the radio. That's freedom, right? That's a freedom that's different from going radio bad for Steve, I just won't turn on the radio anymore, right? There's nothing inherently bad about the radio, is it? If you can listen with a totally free, open mind, enjoy the music, if it's on, it's on, if it's off, it's off, it doesn't make any difference. Your happiness, your well-being, your peace of mind is undisturbed, right? You have an equanimous mind. You have an open, spacious mind, right? It's like thoughts, right? Many people, when they begin their practice, see thoughts as the enemy, is thoughts are the disturber of my meditation, right? So what do I got to do? I got to get rid of the goddamn thoughts, right? Because there you renounce the thought, get rid of the thoughts, you know, struggle with them, right? Because I think thoughts are the enemy. The thoughts aren't the enemy. Thoughts are just thoughts. You know, you create a spacious, open enough mind, thoughts will just come and go, undisturbed. Is the sky disturbed? you know, by the birds flying through it? Right? Does the sky say, the birds flying through my space? No, plenty of room, right? Like that. So, to understand ultimately the nature of mind, the nature of phenomena, the empty nature, is in a certain way, if there's any kind of renunciation, it just happens freely. It's not a rigid kind of, because again, phenomena, things, thoughts are not the enemy. They're not the problem, right? This watch did not make me want it, right? This made me want it. Why? Because I didn't, one, understand that this is just, what is this? I mean, what is it? Metal? Certain shape? I think it's probably leather, you know? Little metal things going round. I mean, is this calling me to, I mean, people talk that way. It just called me. I was just in the store and it called me. Right? I was in my living room and I heard the ice cream calling me from the freezer. I mean, people talk this way. I don't know if you know people like this. No, it doesn't work that way. The voice you hear is inside your own mind. Right? Ice cream does not call you. Cake does not call you. Even chocolate doesn't call you. It's the mind that grasps, the mind that needs, the mind that wants, the mind that seeks. Right? And when one sees that there's no inherent happiness in things, understanding, then the grasping will cease of itself. If you think the rainbow is real and you want to find the rainbow, you're going to be doing a lot of walking, a lot of driving, right? And you'll never get there, right? Because the rainbow, even though it appears in the sky, is not real. You cannot find it. You cannot grab it, right? When you know that, right? When the rainbow appears, you're just very happy to stare and enjoy it. Without saying, I've got to get it, right? Like the moon tonight. It rises. You know, in that moment, how wonderful, right? Nothing needs to be said. How magical. We don't have to grasp, we don't have to say, God, why can't there be a full moon like this every night? Right? The nights would be so much better, right? If, you know. Because it's so unique. That's why it's wonderful. Anyhow, we should stop. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for coming.